Hello and welcome to Women Rise, a podcast about women changemakers that explores the emergence of a new leadership paradigm which calls us to lead from within. I'm your host, Claire Molinard, and I live and work on the island of Corsica in the south of France. I'm a holistic coach and therapist. I teach and facilitate developmental programs for conscious women changemakers, helping them move from depleted and disconnected to resourced and interconnected. Every week, I meet with other women leaders and we explore the inner game of leadership and how, in these times of emergency, we are being called to our unique self-emergence to co-create a world that works for everyone.
I am delighted to welcome Tiffany Lowe on this new episode of Women Rise. Tiffany is a dedicated mother of a toddler. She is a passionate gender rights activist and a resilient leader who has been involved in a number of very interesting and fascinating projects, some of which she'll share with us today. Tiffany, it's a delight to have you here. Welcome to Women Rise. And please, why don't you get us started with letting us feel into what animates your activism at the moment?
Thank you for having me, Claire. It's actually a real honor to be invited to chat with you today. Yeah, so just a little bit about me. Right now, today, I'm a product manager at Everdriven. And there, I'm helping really focus on getting special needs children to and from school in a way that keeps their dignity and they can get their education that they also deserve. I'm also a gender rights activist, toddler mom. And these are some of the things that, you know, I spend outside my job doing, raising my child, working on parts of social impact that really matter to me, such as the gender rights movement that's going on globally. Today, I'm taking a position on the board, KenSid, to support individuals who are disabled and want to continue the dignity of their life as they move on into more and more into adulthood and require the support to do that. Yeah, but that's just like a little bit about me, and I'm really happy to share more as we kind of chat today. I'm so excited to be here.
Thank you. That's beautiful. I just love to hear the passion behind your words, Tiffany. And I would say that that's a beautiful characteristic of many of the women that I interview here on this podcast, is how passionate you are about your work, about what you advocate for. And as you know, what I'm passionate about is to detect the emotion, the feelings, the heart-led energy and passion that is behind a woman's activism. To me, this is really the fire that animates your activism, that heart energy.
Yeah, I feel like I do see that, like, this generation, folks like me, they come at this with their own unique fire. You know, I wouldn't say that I'm a part of Gen Z. I guess that's the generation that I observe now. But I hear a lot about Gen Z, for example, and, you know, within my generation, that kind of cascades, whether it's taking to their neighborhoods and streets to protest something like Roe v. Wade, or whether it is just fighting, using the internet to fight against bigger issues that are happening. I mean, another thing that I find interesting too is some of the allies that kind of have shown up in this generation. I'm going to name one actually. I can't say that maybe they're the perfectest, but it's just interesting to see this difference that, you know, women have backing them and these early generations. Anonymous, you know, I was recently watching a documentary, and it was of an individual whose name I don't think even deserves to be mentioned, really. And he did something awful, posting people's personal things to the internet. And the way that the mother fought for her daughter, and they all fought for themselves, and the way Anonymous got involved, it's like we're dealing with a generation of people, of women, who are not taking it. So just, we bring a type of fire that I think is inspiring, and it continues to inspire as we continue to bring more young women and girls into the world and allies as well. I'm a toddler boy mom, so I'm trying to make sure that I don't hide or shield him from the realities that is something that women face, girls face every day. And wanting him to be a part of that allyship, knowing that it can't be performative. It can't be when it's convenient, when it sounds good to say. It's something that you take with you to the grave, really. It's not meant to be uncomfortable. If you think about, as I'm a Black woman, you think about allyship and slavery, you know, for it to change, it took us and others who were willing to be crucified just for standing for human rights at that point in time. And that's something that I'm demonstrating to him. Yes, he's very young, and I don't have the opportunity to do something as wild as, but it's to say how I carry myself in the conversations that we have and the material that we read, right? There's children's books. There is certain entertainment program that can be utilized to help support the education for myself and for, you know, for his young mind as we kind of grow up. And, you know, but yeah, this generation, you know, just taking it back, there's a lot of opportunity to get involved in social activism in a way that maybe our forefathers and our parents might not have been able to do. But I don't say the internet is as complete as a relatively new thing either. You know, it's been around a decent amount of time, but I think it's just like we have come to the understanding, like we're utilizing these tools now to really go in and take charge of issues and make our voice be known. And I think it's such an important time where we're at right now. And it's important that we continue to shine that light on the abilities that women and girls have to be able to lead this conversation, lead these initiatives that we see in our home front, our backyards, at government levels, at global levels. Because this is really a global fight if you think about it. What goes on in different countries, it really sends that resounding sound. What happens when we sit here in the comforts of the United States, right? Or at least where I sit anyway, you know, but it does have an impact. It does cut deep because it reminds me that I am a woman and I could very easily be there or have been born there. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just by birth that I ended up here, you know, dealing with my own issues. And it's not to say anyone's issues are lesser or greater. They're issues that no one should have to, as a human, have to go through. It's ridiculous. All rights are important, but we need to make women's mm-hmm. rights equal, if not most important right now, because they're just not being listened to.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking of the women in Iran, and it's been going on for decades mm-hmm. and more recently in September, and we hardly hear about them. No.
Yeah.
So to bring it back to your work, Tiffany, how do you reconcile your daily job and your activism and your toddler mom role? And that's very familiar for a woman, right? To be playing all those different roles. How do you keep the fire going?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I've had a thought about this in the past, and I think the fire kind of lights up when I ask myself, oh, are you done yet? And then I kind of go, I don't know. We'll see what comes around, you know? And I say that like, cause it's been, you know, recently feels like recently, but I guess it's been some time. For about 4 years, I had volunteered and contracted with an NGO called CHEN, and their mission is to fight gender-based violence on a global scale. You know, I spent a lot of time there. I mean, I didn't imagine what life would look like not volunteering or contracting or being a part of, you know, the day-to-day there in some way. At some point, I wanted to kind of move more into product management away from being a software engineer. And it was an opportunity for me to do that. So I took the opportunity, but knew that I couldn't balance the two. So eventually, I wouldn't say I entirely exited the organization, as I'm still part of the community to some facet. I took that time to kind of step away from being a gender rights activist and really propel myself into understanding product management and understanding how actually product management solves a lot of the problems that we had been solving at CHEN, conducting those survivor interviews to understand how to build trauma-informed designs. So that's really what propelled me. It was a kind of a hand-in-hand. And I think when I spend a lot of time just kind of working in what I'm doing already, things that kind of interconnect, it just kind of reignites that flame. Even when I come to what I thought was a pause, getting the education at the accelerator program I went to, PM Dojo, and then getting my first opportunity, I wasn't completely active as a social activist. And it's like, oh, is that something wrong with that? But I believe that multitasking, if you want to call it that, kind of looks like working on different parts of yourself. It doesn't have to be both hands constantly moving, like moving both my hands here, constantly moving to like state the case that you are an excellent multitasker, but it could be something about how you position yourself in your mind, right? Like, what's up next? What are you feeling like right now? And like really tapping into that self thought and reflection and then setting out those plans of what feels right. And I think that's kind of what happened for me, just like coming out of the program there and moving into that first role and even getting impacted by a layoff at some point, you know, but still keeping my sights into companies that I felt like would be a good fit for my subject matter expertise. So why that might not be complete activism, you know, the idea of supporting children getting to from school, you know, children with disabilities and special needs, is that it's something that I felt it was an honor when I was recruited to work there after being impacted by that layoff. And I think it just kind of came full, like a bit of a circle here for somebody who's like heart is concerned about these kind of issues. And it can be monetary. Yeah, it's a private company. It's not an NGO. But I think all work, if done correctly, is important. And I see it as an opportunity for me to bring in some of the understandings of mental health and the understandings of some of the social issues and issues with disabilities that there is, that they're more marginalized for abuse as well. So this is the opportunity that I have, being able to own this product line here at Ever Driven, for example, and so on and so forth. I think that might answer your question there, but maybe not. But yeah, I think it's just really spending time thinking about what it is that kind of ignites that flame, and maybe I'm giving myself a pause. Maybe I'm quiet for about a month, and that's okay. I think I'm recharging to get back to the next thing where somebody will message me, you know, and that's just kind of how it happens. So,
oh, I love that. I love that because there is a kind of gentleness and capacity to be in the stillness. There's a way in which activism can be angry, which I think often is the shadow of activism. And what you're speaking to here is different. There is a sort of a wisdom, a capacity to be in a quieter place and to still tend to the fire.
Yeah, I'd say so.
And that's actually a feminine quality, to be able to wait. I mean, we carry a child in our belly for 9 months. So there is this capacity to hold something, to be a container for something to be born. That's innate in us. And I'm kind of recognizing that in what you just said, you know, it's a great quality to have for an activist.
Yeah, I can definitely agree with you on that. I think, and I'll be transparent. If anyone who followed me during my pregnancy, your friend or someone I chatted with a lot online, I did not enjoy waiting. It's not easy because we're human. And the idea of being that container or that waiting period that some of us might have experienced already, might be thinking about doing, might be unsure about, choice for everyone. It's not, you're going to go into it and you're going to think, oh my God, what have I done? But then you're counting the days. It's like, when can I go back to laying how I used to lay? Hanging out with my friends, and I'm not feeling like, oh, I feel spent. I'm ready to go home after a couple of minutes. But I think it's like, for me, it helped set me up to be more disciplined, if you will, as a person. You know, I wanted to have my child. I planned to have my child as well. I say that because I have an autoimmune disease called lupus. So I wasn't able to just like surprise and like just try and they'll come when they come. I had to like, okay. So I didn't get that opportunity of surprise. But, you know, with all that planning, my mind was very aware. But it wasn't until I got pregnant that I was like, what in the world? It's just like, I'm just waiting here. I'm not doing much that I'd like to do. I did work with Chen during my pregnancy, which was tough. It was like a challenge because I was tired and just not feeling, you know, myself. And everyone's pregnancy is going to be different too. It's another thing I do want to call out. For me, it was pretty tough. But I think what I got out of it really was just kind of, you know, unknowingly even, just able to just wait and hold out and be patient. I'd like to imagine that people who've experienced abuse themselves personally, such as I have, you learn to bide your time. You learn to wait. And unfortunately, women are more marginalized to experience, you know, violence or abuse against them. And not for short periods of time, usually I think it's safe to say that we find ourselves in these situations for a while, you know, quote unquote, it's not easy to walk away. It's dangerous for us to walk, to get out. If we make out, you know, make it out, we don't know if they'll come after us. That's why we stay, right? And then we bide our time. And I say all this to say is like, it's almost either built into us to do this. Maybe we just get the most practice to do it, whether we want it to in some cases of abuse. But, you know, and I don't think anybody wants to, but that's what something that is taken out of that. It's like that biding your time and just being patient and waiting for your next opportunity. But when a woman is ready to make those changes or her opportunity of waiting, whether you're pregnant here and back to that kind of conversation here ends, oh, we turn into another person, you know, again, we shift, you know, we adapt. We're so adaptable to our environment, our changes, and we're so very self-aware of what we need to do. I guess we grow up quickly, some of us, and we make the changes that need to be made. And so I like the way you kind of went with this, but this.
Yeah, I'd like to bring a distinction because I think there are two different things here. I was pointing to this capacity to be a container and to be in stillness, trusting that something beautiful is going to come out of it, a child in the example of being pregnant, but also, you know, I was resonating to what you said about it's okay to be in the quiet, something else will come up. So there's actually a lot of power there. And that's, yeah. I think, different from the quiet of a victim or an abused person who's used to holding it, right? So it's a little different, but I get what you're saying. There's also some of that in, you know, being able to wait. Yeah. It builds resiliency.
Exactly.
And that's probably the gift in the abuse. And because you brought it up, I like to ask you.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, we're animated by a sense of injustice that fuels our activism. And that itself is informed by what we went through ourselves. What is your sense of how your own story has informed your activism?
I've never really sat with this question, but I've always answered it just simply so. Like, if I want to be really honest here, why I do identify as a survivor of abuse, there was a period of a break even. What was it? I wasn't full-on activist the day it happened. And, you know, it wasn't full-on activist the next day. It was a period of like just being just so, I don't know what my mind was doing. I was doing a lot of other things that definitely wasn't for healing. I threw myself into therapy just because it was expected of me to do so to prove that this happened. I was doing all the things to prove to my family, to friends that yes, something that happened that I did not want to happen to me. And just trying to follow what I thought maybe the script is, because I don't know, the world has a script for us that I still have yet to see what their script is. But they're very quick to point your finger when they feel like, oh no, there's no way this person, this happened to them. They're lying. They're making it up. Oh, that's a great person that they're trying to ruin. You know, so within a period of maybe some years, a couple years, maybe, I mean, I had left New York City when it happened and stayed with family and realized quickly I needed to go back to New York City because it's not where I wanted to be. It brought up a lot of the childhood abuse there too. So I wanted to go back and I worked some odd jobs back in New York City. And then I had gotten laid off. I think I was moving from one engineering job to another in which we had a layoff situation happen. And I felt so defeated. Like it brought up all these feelings, just a very painful time because I thought I was going to finally get my life on track. I had recently gotten married. I had put all that behind me, the friendships that I had lost because of my assault years. And we're talking 2011 to 2016, 15, where I sat. And I think if it wasn't for getting laid off, I wouldn't have explored the internet. I guess it's like us looking for resources. We're always just kind of looking for something, you know, our next thing. I was looking for a job, really. And I found this beautiful website that talked a lot about gender rights activism, had resources, had guides. It was called Chen. And I'm like, oh, I'd love to work here. This is the kind of space that I feel like really connected with me. And mind you, Had I done activism work? Maybe not really, other than taking myself to groups for sexual violence groups and like sharing my story here and there. But not to the capacity. I mean, Chen opened up a lot of opportunities by joining them. And I didn't think I'd be contracting with them sometimes and mostly volunteering. But I signed up to join because that was where I was. And from there, I opened up so many opportunities. I spoke at the mayor's office in New York City. I was pretty pregnant. Riding the subway was not fun at all. But I wasn't going to take the car because it was just too much. And the steering wheel and the whole thing, it's just too much. But getting to speak there on issues regarding sexual violence and some of the laws that they wanted to pass and they wanted us to speak on, some of the changes there, and going to GitHub Universe, TechSpace, that is like so my vibe, you know, to share about a platform and resources that we created, like our Soul Medicine platform, giving bite-sized information to people who want to take back their lives and control parts of their lives if they're in an abusive situation. Mental health guide that I had was a project lead on, we shared about there. And it's just, so I could go on and on, but there's just so many things. I think that first 4 years was just like, I was a whole nother person doing what I loved. It wasn't, again, it might not always be instant for everyone. Like, okay, this happens to you. And now your childhood spoke to this, because I had abusive childhood, you know, domestic violence being in the home and manipulation and abuse and things like that. But I didn't take off then. It wasn't until another horrific situation, and then I didn't take off even then per se. But I think it was, you know, aligning myself with the community, educating myself before I spoke, because a lot of the things that I probably might have said were probably not the best way to say these things if you want people to believe in your mission, to believe in why this is important, that women and girls need to be protected. We need to be able to go out in public spaces, have our truths be heard and never questioned. And I want to thank Hera Hussein, actually, the founder of Chen, who really guided and steered the organization. She is a leader like no other. And now she's on maternity leave. And she's enjoying her time as she gears up to step through the same footsteps I went through. But I think that organization really provided me the space to run with activism the way I did and be here today to speak on issues. I think one of the hardest and scariest time I reflect on of issues spoken on, but I think it needed to happen, was, again, still very pregnant, and went to the United Nations to speak about youth entrepreneurship. I mean, it was one of the probably larger highlights, you know, that really kind of shook me in a very positive way, like this, about how important all the sustainable goals are. Gender rights activism is important. And I took that as an example, which is why now I'm, again, partnering with Kenson here on the board, because that's not in line with gender rights activism exactly. But it's still, I think, something that social issue, like being understanding what it means to be a social activist, a human rights activist. Those are more larger umbrella terms, I'd say. But you don't always have to stay in your jam. Like, I just stay here. And there's a lot that connects and that can be learned if it doesn't connect, and that can be connected if you just make that connection. So,
yeah, you know, there's a way in which when we are victims of abuse, we can stay in that identification to being a victim, right? We can be trapped in that role. And as long as we identify to only that role, there's no way out. There's no possibility of transformation. It's only by integrating that part of ourselves within a larger story, within a larger script, that we can be liberated, or we can understand this part of our life within the larger script of our life. And that's the possibility of transformation. And I think that's where activism can draw its power. We all have a unique story, and we all have a unique story of wounding. And in the very wound of our story, there's also a script for the type of fixing, the type of healing that we can offer the world. I think these two are related if we can find the golden thread that runs under. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that our wounds inform the medicine that we are able to bring to the world that is unique to us. Because we have a unique wounding, we also have a unique medicine, a unique healing. There's a particular way that we perceive the world, that we're intimate with the world, that is going to inform our activism. And our soul is equipped with the wisdom that can recognize that when we liberate ourselves from that role of the victim, that is the condition, that is the clarification that is necessary. And I think that it's the role of every activist to clarify that for themselves. And with you, I really have the sense that you are drawing from that wisdom. You have access to this guidance.
Yeah, I think wisdom is something that, you know, is given to us by experiences that we will take for ourselves, whether it's a course or experiences that are literally put on our lap that we didn't ask for. But again, I think that really speaks to what the word we had mentioned earlier, and this is resilience. You know, with that births resilience, kind of going through these experiences, difficult, even the ones that we ask for, whether it's being pregnant, or maybe saying, oh, I want to go back into a world of tech and coding. That was my security blanket. This is something that I did. I went back into coding in my life after putting it down. It was something that I did as a child to protect myself from the things around me. And I coded my heart out, created my own world, built my own signs and layouts and all these things on the web, and went back and stepped through that experience of saying, I want to make this a professional career. I want to do this not because I needed to protect myself from my childhood memories, but because I'm intelligent. I can do this. I've done it before. It's a good starting point for a career. And all these, I mean, women are strategical, right? We're going to pick up something that we know if we can. Sometimes we want to pivot into things that we've never gotten to because we're fearless as well. You know, we have a lot of qualities. For me, strategically, it made sense. So I did it. But I knew it wasn't going to be easy because I was wading into an experience of like opening a computer, getting into a coding editor, and trying to keep up with where the world was at with technology was a challenge. Trying to not write lines of codes that felt familiar that brought up memories for me. Like as I write a line of code, I remember when I first wrote this line of code, I was 13. So, and just kind of like stepping through the experience, but that's an experience that I wanted to go through. I needed to go through. And out of that came resilience. So that way I could persevere through this. And I think if we do that time and time again, I mean, now I'm a product manager and it was a new experience that I had to go through. It was not easy, but it was one that I feel like, again, helped me be more resilient. And all these things, these experiences are the wisdom that we gather up. I mean, I wasn't born with wisdom, so I had to go through like hard experiences that I picked for myself, hard experiences that were given to me, or maybe even easy experiences, right? That weren't so bad, but that was interesting. That was a learning point kind of thing. And I think that's really what supports us to build out that wisdom, what to do for ourselves in the future. We get to learn more about ourselves too, what we're capable of, what we're not going to put up with. I think I've become more no-nonsense as I've become a mom as well. Not to say that I'm not fun, you know, but just like that, yeah, I'm not afraid to speak in front of senior leaders. I'm not afraid to do things that are scary. And I say this because it's the experiences that remember that I'm human and that I, you know, what is failure? I think that's another thing. We kind of worry about failure and we want to gather all the wisdom before we traverse through things. But I think sometimes it's okay to go through the experience, even if you don't have all the wisdom, because it just makes that knowledge that you're going to walk away from even more valuable. So I think that's what I have to say on that. But thank you. I'm glad you think I'm a wise individual. I never really thought of that.
Yeah, it's my passion to recognize that in women and to reflect it to them. I do believe that we all have access to wisdom, love, and power, that these are forces that we can cultivate. Again, it's about clarifying what clouds our personality and cultivating the capacity to access the love in our heart, the wisdom of our mind, and the power of our bodies. These are natural centers of intelligence which we can access. It's a continual process of cultivation. And it's also a capacity. These are capacities that I see are coming online in women. And in men, of course, but my work is focused on women leadership. So I really believe that it's from that integrated heart, mind, and body intelligence that we can begin to be a powerful agents of change for creating a world that works for everyone. And we're doing this together. I'm feeling that there is a strong wave of men and women that are really coming together, that are becoming agents of change beyond the polarities, the huge polarities that are separating, that are forces of separation in the world today.
Yeah, there's a lot of differences now today and how we're coming together to make the world that we want to be. I hate to say that quote, I've said it a few times, is like, be the change that you want to see.
Well, it's but still it's relevant. It's relevant.
Natural.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's an important one. This is where it starts. Each one of us is the change, but there is also a sense that this is happening on a collective level today. It's way beyond individual change.
How about we change gears, Tiffany? I think it would be interesting for our listeners to also touch on parenting. As we mentioned earlier, and your toddler is about to turn 4, and your life has changed a lot, obviously, having him. I'd love to hear from you how that affects and has affected your life as an activist and as a woman.
Yeah, it doesn't make anything in life, whether I was an activist or whether I wasn't, whether anything you do in life does become harder because you are caring for such a young mind that needs to be fed and, you know, clothed, and just really you are their world at this, especially early age. I mean, you'll always be their world in some capacity as well as they get older. It just gets more complicated. So I hear from other folks who have older children.
I agree, you know, with that one.
Yeah, I hear that a lot at work. I joke with my boss. I'm like, oh, I'm so looking forward to like just a different perspective right now. And he's like, oh, it just gets more complicated. It's like, thanks a lot. But to be honest, it's not easy. It definitely is a walk in the park. But I think it's important to make sure you go in with it every day, with that in the forefront of your mind. Not that it's not easy, but that you have to be adaptable to the changes of the day, or know that you might not get to do what you like to do today. I mean, I could have a schedule laid out, right? My son could just want to do other things, and not because he wants to do other things, because he's saying it. His emotions are just very raw at this age. The tantrums, the unpredictability of toddlers, that's just how they are. They're very unpredictable. And I think if you go into it, you being the adult, knowing that you set boundaries for yourself, knowing that, like, okay, his nap time, actually, that's not true. He doesn't take a nap anymore. But let's just say, for the sake of example here, for folks who have nap times still for their toddlers or their babies, I recommend taking advantage of those times, maybe to fill your cup up, whether it's sitting in your silence, whether it's working on a piece, maybe getting a nap in, doing whatever it is that serves you in those times. But like learning to, I guess we talked about earlier, like biding your time in a sense, right? Knowing that when it's the weekend, I'm not answering a whole lot of social media. I'm not doing a whole lot. And it's like setting boundaries, because earlier on when I came into this, there was a lot of friction, frustration. I mean, we kind of want to do what we want to do, right, throughout our days. But we have to understand that eventually our toddlers or our children will go to sleep. And maybe we can get an hour or two at bedtime once you put them to sleep there, and to do what we like to do. But like really setting like these boundaries and putting in perspective that this is a new time in your life, and you're not going to have that full run of your schedule. You might have a good day where the schedule that you've set out works out great, but also keeping in mind that it fills the cup up of your child, because they are also a human being too, and they are watching and learning the interactions between other humans, which is why you are their world, and they're observing from you. And if it's time to get on the floor and play with blocks with baby, that's what you should be doing. Work can wait. I think it's very important to be very careful and intentional about how you lay out your day to day with a child for anything to work, and also seeking help, building a village where you don't have a village if you can. Whether it's outsourcing help from parents or family, or maybe you can't afford to have a babysitter to come and visit in sporadically or occasionally to give you the breaks that you need. Or there's a care group or a nursery group that you can drop your little one off at. I mean, even that takes time, because you have to build up like the, well, my child doesn't have separation anxiety. I don't think he ever did. I don't know. He wasn't a Klingon baby. He was the kind of kid that would just go hug people he didn't know, and he still does that. But these are the things that have to be worked on first, so you have to be cognizant of. before you really start saying this is how it's going to be. And and I hate to break it to you, it changes. Once you get into a schedule, they grow up some more, and then you're just like, okay, naps are over. Like in our house, naps have ended over like a year and a half ago when my mom came to visit and she saw I was trying to put him down for a 45-minute nap. I think we spent like 35 minutes trying to put him down. Mm-hmm. And she said, you are killing yourselves. This child is not tired. And I think it also feeding into the ideologies of like what toddlers or babies are supposed to be doing. I mean, every child is different. I think we do that a lot as humans. We script a lot. Like we read these scripts and we run with it. Like it has to, the show must go on just like that for it to be true, right? And we talked about that earlier.
We resist reality.
Yeah, you know, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, great advice. And the emphasis on self-care while caring for your child and realizing that you have a unique human being in front of you and that's a new phase of your life. It'll never be again the same as it was before. So there's no need to resist how it is and try and bring it back to some normality. The normality is changing all the time. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Hopefully one day having a nursery in the workplace will be a common thing. And not an exception. I know that it exists already in private organizations in many cultures, but having access to a nursery at your workplace is still a big luxury.
I think that says a lot about society and our culture. You know, I came into motherhood like really feeling everything I heard about. It's so hard being a mom. Like, and let's just put it in perspective, right? We're going to put it into the United States because that's where I can only base my experience off of, right? But I think it's safe to say that this is probably the most non-family-centric country. Despite, you know, you always hear, people always hear, oh, you know, America, family values. And I mean, what are their values? I'm not sure then, because we lack so much in, you know, healthcare for women. I mean, we just gotten our healthcare rights punched in the gut, you know, more than a year ago. Right. Yeah, you know, and then, you know, then there's the, like you mentioned, you know, there are nurseries in some places. It's a good model to go off of. But I mean, the U.S. isn't taking notice and saying, hey, you know who's the pillar of our society? Children and women, families are the pillar of our society. So let's support them. They're not doing that. I mean, I think food stamps I had recently, and I've heard about it before. But I just never, it never really sat with me because I've actually used the government benefits before on and off throughout my life as I needed it. But there's a timeline, and I probably should have looked this up before I say this, but like about 7 years you can use it. After that, you can't use it anymore. From what I understand, and feel free to back this up with like sources, but I was reading something of that nature. That does sound familiar. After you've used it, like you could use it for a year, you're good, your life is back on track. 2 years later, something catastrophic happens. You got to get back on it. Okay, now you're back on it again for another year. And each year that you're on it, I guess they count that as the year. Like, okay, you had snaps this year. And if it's consecutive, obviously it's consecutive. But like, you know, maybe for 3 years, you were good. But it adds up to this, I think it's about 7 years. And I'm not sure it's by state, but I've heard this. And I'm thinking like, wow, this is to say that people would never find themselves. I mean, if you find yourself in a situation, let's just say seven times. You know, does that, what are we saying about people? Or we're so quick to judge. How could you not figured it out seven times, right? That just puts more, at least I feel like that's just a conversation, like what that says. I think it should be something that anyone can use without having any kind of cap, because we can't say what people's needs are or what they're going through. And then you think about like the elderly population and what they need. And anyway, the way we're set up here, it's just not really thinking about the struggles of parent life and motherhood and of course, companies. Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and of course, the most vulnerable are the single mothers.
Exactly.
Vulnerable social places, often of color.
Yeah, that's spot on. And the resources that we do have are a drop in the hat to a resounding problem that we have throughout this country. I remember like when I recently had my son, we were looking to go out to eat with friends, and we were still living in New York, and I think he had like 4 months or so, maybe 5 months. And I'm over here scouting to check for changing tables in the bathrooms so we could decide on whether we're going to eat here or not. I mean, we hear about men's bathrooms not usually having changing tables, which I think they're trying to be better about here. I haven't kept up with it, but when you change the baby in the bathroom on a table, it folds out. Some restaurants don't even have, and I guess it's to say that parents aren't supposed to go out to eat and children aren't welcome here. What does that say? I don't know. It was just an afterthought. Like, oh, we didn't think about it. I mean, to be fair, New York doesn't have the best space for things either. I mean, apartments are the size of shoeboxes, to be fair, but maybe that's what happened. The bathroom just wasn't going to fit something that falls, you know, out. Like, I don't know. But like, you know, but these are the things that we are cognizant of. You've become cognizant of as a mother, as a parent. When you're literally trying to scout out your day of what's going to work for you, what's going to be a space that is going to work for your family, what you go get a meal, who's going to be around, what time of day it is, because you don't want your child crying and disturbing other people, going into the store, getting judged. And I think as a society, like, when we see crying children, we just think, oh, what a failure of a parent.
Yeah. What I'm thinking of is that to bring it back to leadership, which is our kind of umbrella topic, there is a way in which, and I've had that conversation a few times now with women who work in international development. What they tell me is that even though there is a desire to respect the quotas, often in international development, you see that women leaders are secondary and the leadership is still quite male dominated.
Yeah.
And so what happens is that when you put more female leadership, the projects are different. They're more focused on community development, on certain needs that are often not addressed. So I think that you're actually speaking to that. You know, there's a way in which women perceive reality from a different angle, and therefore they bring solutions that have never been thought of by men. In one of my podcasts, I'm speaking with this woman who works in the blue economy in Southeast Asia. And she was making an important point. She was basically saying, we have 10 years. And we need to bring more women here because they bring solutions that are working and they're actually responding to the issues that we have. And we don't have an indefinite time to address these issues.
It makes a lot of sense. And I think for more as a product person, you think about users, right, who have the pain points and the experience and who are constantly going through the issues constantly and what a solution looks like. We are a perfect example of these experiences, our pain points. We lived it. We are aware of our reality that in order to get through what we need to get through, we need to do X, Y, Z. And this is just how it's going to be. And so maybe our counterparts, you know, men, they don't have these experiences. So they're going to come in with like, oh, we want to do all the right things, do the good things. But that's just a very vague umbrella to like what a solution really looks like that solves the problems for families. Like, families aren't just men, and families aren't just children, and families aren't just mothers. We need to look at a very, like I said, a holistic view of breaking it down. Who are each of these different groups, children, fathers, mothers, even families who may not identify to the typical heterosexual norm, like really honing in on some of these pain points, these problems that they have, and like letting them share those problems. Because I find that like in my work, when I listen to what the problems are, it helps lead me to the solutions. Like, wow, 25% of these people are saying the same thing over and over again, or 50%, so on and so forth. And it really guides me to, okay, this is what a solution looks like. But in this case, as you mentioned, the woman you spoke with on the last podcast, that I'm pretty sure we can roll out with a solution ASAP. Because women have been doing this for so long, there's really nothing to test out. Let's just do the work now.
Just listen to them. Yeah.
Yeah. And listen and get there.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but I think one of the things that we can do, and we think of taking it back as far as being a leader, being a woman who leads, is like really trying to get that buy-in from if our bosses above us are identifying us as white male, or maybe you just aren't cognizant to our issues, but really having these kind of conversations on a human level. And maybe you could be the one to bring in something that's more focused to the needs of women. Like, childcare usually falls on women to figure out, right? So if a company starts to open up some type of nursery, or like partnering with I know there's like apps like Urban Sitter and Sitter City, where they have like an employment thing where I guess they could add that to the benefits. And maybe your child's out sick and you need to get a nanny to come, someone who will work with children who are sick, because some people won't because they're sick. But, you know, you could have them come in so you can at least get like 4 to 8 hours of your day of work done. You know, so there's that support, right? And I think it really comes down to us continuing to do what we do best and making our case. And getting that buy-in, building those relationships first, right? With our bosses or people around us that may have the more influential power than we might. And that's what leadership can also look like. It's not always like, oh, I'm a leader, so I'm going to like draft up this proposal that's going to change all these things. Leadership is a movement of getting people to understand and believe what you believe in, maybe even feel or sympathize very deeply with you, and to motivate and move people from places to places in their hearts to help you enact change. And I think that's where it starts, kind of keeping up that collective thought there, really just getting people to, persuading people to help you and other women benefit from what we need, whether it's childcare, whether it's resources to becoming a better leader. And I think that we just really should lean into like those feminine qualities, lean into our heart, and like just really speak from a place of the, you know, these experiences. I think those are some of the things that really is going to set apart whether we move into a direction that really benefits women or we continue to like have these wishes and goals that we're aspiring to. So
beautiful. I think this is a good place to stop. We could just go on forever. I mean, there's a lot of I just want to reflect to you right now the vulnerability that you speak to. Thank you so much for this conversation. It was beautiful.
Thank you, Claire. It was lovely to be here.
Thank you for listening to Women Rise. If you enjoyed the show today, please leave us a review. To get announcements when a new podcast is published, send me an email at claire@uniqueselfemergence.com. to be added on my distribution list. If you're interested in being a guest on my podcast or you would like to join my private free group for female leaders, go to my podcast description for the links to apply. Thanks again and see you soon on the Women Rise podcast.